Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. You may be seated. Well, good morning. It is good to worship with you all this morning. My name is Andrew Beard. I'm the pastor here at the chapel at Seaside. As a kid, you know, people do a lot of interesting things to like, little imagination kind of things. For some reason, I like wanted to run like a dry cleaning shop as a kid. That's what I imagined. Not a lot of kids play in a dry cleaner, but I did. So my dad, he had one of those little like, I don't even know what you call the thing. It heats up, you know, coffee cup, like they keep your coffee cup on it, keeps the coffee cup warm. So I would take that and I'd pretend like it was an iron, like I was ironing. Well, it turns out if you leave that thing upside down on carpet, carpet will catch on fire. And I found that out as a small child because I was pretending to iron and I left it there and it caught on fire. And so then I walked out and I told my parents, the family room's on fire and smoke was billowing out. And of course they were like, what? And then they ran back there and put it out. So, you know, I did this thing and I thought, well, that was my past. So I have two children and my children are Foster and Keating, but they shall remain nameless of who was the responsible one for this act, for the sake of their embarrassment. We have in our bathroom, you know, matches and candles and whatnot. And, one day one of my children, decided he would light some of the toilet paper on fire. So I don't know if you know this, that toilet paper burns very quickly, mind you. Even if you throw it in the toilet, it still burns. And the bottom of my toilet seat is little burn marks inside the toilet. So this happened. This is a real thing. It really happened. And Sarah and I found out about it, and we were like, let's not light things on fire in general, but specifically in our house, specifically in the bathroom. Let's just avoid that altogether, like my house. Don't want it to burn down. That feels like a responsible thing. So one day, maybe a couple weeks after that situation happened, Sarah and I are talking, and I hear from the bathroom one of my children screaming, oh my gosh, it's on fire, it's on fire. So of course, like I experienced this as a child. I saw him experience this. I go running into the room and I'm like, oh my gosh, what's wrong? And he goes, oh, nothing. We're just out of toilet paper. Could you get me? I knew you'd come running if I yelled that. So just know, unless I see fire or smoke, I'm not running towards anything. That's just the reality. I mean, some of us, we have certain check marks of whether we're going to respond to something, some sort of confirmation in our head or our mind, whether we or our heart, whether we see something or are going to respond to it. We want a sign. We want a confirmation. We want to know that something is legit or real before we respond to this, won't we? This is why we double check emails. We don't just like buy into some prince who wants to give us some inheritance, because we want a confirmation that that is real. We don't just take anything that is offered to us. We are people who want to know that it is real. We want to have legit signs to know we are headed in the right direction. We are getting what we think is coming to us. But I wonder, do we maybe potentially even miss out on things that God has for us? Not because God isn't doing stuff, or not because God hasn't offered things for you, but because we miss the signs that God has for us. Maybe we have fixed our eyes on something else. And what could we be missing out on because we are not paying attention? What could we be missing out on or losing because we don't see the signs? We're going to take a look at this today. We're going to be in Mark chapter 8. You can turn there. I want to give you just a little bit of setup before we jump in, some background on Mark chapter 8. So to give you some background, Jesus has been on quite this extended kind of ministry journey, ministry tour. He's been doing ministry around the Sea of Galilee area. In that area, Jesus has been doing teaching and miracles, and masses of people have been following after him. He already has his 12 disciples. They've been journeying with him on this whole journey, but more and more people are starting to follow after Jesus and know what he is talking about, what he is doing. And if we look at some of the things that have happened just in the last couple of chapters, we saw that Jesus fed 5,000 Hebrew people who were hungry, people that didn't have food, and Jesus was able to provide food for them. Then he calmed a storm, and then he walked on the water, and then he got into some debates with the Pharisees and the religious elites about washing hands and what are the traditions that we place on other people, whether they are necessary or not, and the damage that that does to people. We also talked about what defiles a person and how to be consistent with their faith and their actions as they were following after God. Jesus then, after an extended, exhausting season, goes up to the northwest part of the country. He actually goes up to a coastal community known as Tyre and Sidon, and near the Israel-Lebanon border. And there he encountered a Syrophoenician, or a Canaanite woman. This is a single mom that her child was suffering and was sick and needed help. We talked about this last week, and if you haven't listened to this, I would invite you to check that out online or on the podcast. He goes to this place, and this woman who is worlds apart from where Jesus is. Different religious tradition, different cultural tradition, different race, ethnicity, gender, the whole deal could not be more different than Jesus. And yet she boldly approaches Jesus and asks for him to heal her daughter. And then Jesus makes the oh so fun comment about feeding the children before the dogs. And then she pushes back about how there is still enough crumbs for the dogs. Last week, we looked at this beautiful story about how Jesus came for the Hebrew people. He came for the descendants of Abraham. He came for the children of David and Abraham first, and then for everyone else. It wasn't that Jesus didn't care about everyone else, but no one else was looking for this long-awaited Messiah that was going to welcome them in. They were the ones who were supposed to be on the lookout for him. They were the ones who were supposed to have eyes to see and ears to hear him coming. So Jesus would first care for them and then care for everyone else. Due to this woman's boldness and Jesus' grace and generosity, he obliges and heals this woman's daughter because there is enough for everyone, and persistence matters. Then the very next story that we see in the Gospel of Mark, he journeys from that Gentile region down southeast into another Gentile region known as the Decapolis. The Decapolis is 10 cities that kind of make up this area, 10 kind of Greek-influenced cities that would have had the culture, the religious traditions of Greek. It would not be Hebrew in culture. Jesus journeys to this area and finds a Gentile man who cannot hear or speak. And then Jesus again finds himself healing this man. He finds himself healing this man, giving him ears to hear and words to say. Suddenly he can hear and he can speak. Now, immediately after that, Jesus finds himself again among a crowd of people. This time, it's not 5,000, but it's 4,000, and it's no longer Hebrew people, but it's Gentile people who are hungry. In this, Jesus takes a bit of fish and bread and multiplies them and is able to feed them enough. He's able to give them all that they need. See, this story may seem similar to the first one, but Jesus is demonstrating through this unbelievably powerful truth. Jesus' ministry has shifted from primarily caring for the Hebrews first, those who were supposed to see and hear, those who were hoping that they would recognize and know, to crossing that barrier, crossing that threshold, and healing and caring and feeding all people, wholly free of condition, even those who would seem to not have understood who Jesus was, who the Messiah was. See, Jesus wasn't just caring for the Hebrew people. He was now caring for the Gentiles and everyone. After this feeding miracle, Jesus crosses the Sea of Galilee again from the eastern side to the western side and is back in the area known as Dalmuthna or Magdala. This is where Mary Magdalene is from. And he's back in this densely Hebrew culture. And when he's there, Jesus runs into more religious elites and they are trying to figure him out. He is facing the same challenges he has faced over and over and over again. Questions about who he is. And they've been wrestling to try to understand him and trying to understand, is this really the Messiah that we have been waiting for? With that, let us jump in. Mark 8, starting verse 11. Mark 8, starting verse 11. Then the Pharisees came and began to argue with him, that is Jesus, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. Okay, pause right there. As soon as Jesus gets back into this area, these guys seem to come out wanting to pick a fight again. It's like they are on the lookout to figure Jesus out. They want to catch him or bust him or something. There is something really interesting that is also happening here. Over a relatively short period of time, Jesus has brought an abundance of bread seemingly out of heaven, miraculously caring for these people who are in the wilderness, and suddenly Pharisees start testing Jesus. That little fun parallel about bread being provided and then suddenly a testing for God, about bread being provided and people questioning who God is, we saw that exact same story in the Exodus. For those of you that are familiar with the book of Exodus, when the Hebrew people have been led out of Egypt, led out of slavery towards freedom. They cross through the Red Sea. They're in the wilderness. And of course, they're hungry. And what does God do for them? Provides manna, bread from heaven for them. And immediately after, that's Exodus 16. In Exodus 17, the very next chapter, the people who've just gotten bread from God start saying, wait a second, do we know your God? Should we trust you? And we see them doing the same thing again, but no longer to a God in the skies, but a God who's among them, questioning who he is and starting to test him. History tends to repeat itself, doesn't it? God will provide for us over and over and over again in miraculous and inexplicable ways, and we will continue to test and question God. Here, these Pharisees want a sign that Jesus is who he seems to be, despite the healings, despite the walking on water, despite the calming of the storm, despite the feeding of the masses twice. They want something huge, something undeniable, something that comes from heaven, but really, there seems to be no honesty in their requests. The interesting thing here is the word that is used for test is the same word that is used for tempt. Almost as if they're trying to tempt Jesus. They're trying to trap Jesus. They're trying to catch Jesus. It's not uncommon that when my children come home from school, I'll say, how was your day? And they'll say, great. And I'll say, the principal called. Is there anything you want to tell us? And they sit there paused, confused, shuffling their feet. The principal didn't call. You know that, right? But I use it hoping that if something did happen, they're going to admit it. You all, you can use that on anybody. Just find whatever it is. People are fearful is going to get out or whatever. You can use that. But I don't know what's going on when I ask them that. I'm trying as a parent, hopefully in the running for parent of the year, I'm trying as a parent to get them to admit something that maybe I don't even know about. The Pharisees are doing something similar here with Jesus. They're trying to trap him on something they don't even necessarily know about. Verse 12. And he, that's Jesus, sighed deeply in his spirit and said, why does this generation seek a sign? Truly, I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation. And he left them, got into the boat again, and went away to the other side. Jesus, when he has this encounter, does one of those deep sighs or groans, that whole like a breath to center himself. Like the big exhale you make when things start mounting against you, when it seems like nothing is going well, when you get bad news after bad news and worse situation, and you take that breath. And you almost get the idea that is what Jesus is doing when he sighs out here. Then Jesus uses the term this generation. Okay, this term is not meant to be like, well, the problem with kids these days, or, you know, back in my day, we didn't need signs. Jesus is not doing that. He's not insulting them or somehow that this generation is worse than previous generations, or if it wasn't for the cell phone or MTV or whatever previous things people used to say was a responsibility of why they've gone off the rails. What he's doing here is he's harkening back throughout the scriptures, this generation refers to people that no longer turn or trust in God. And he says, those of you that are not trusting in God, you seek a sign, but you're not going to see a sign even if it comes. you're not going to recognize the sign that's before you because you're not actually seeking one. You won't see it because you aren't looking for it. This term is used to refer to people who didn't believe God or trust in God or were choosing their own ways over God's ways. People who are not authentically looking for a sign will not see a sign. People who are looking for that sign will see it everywhere. So what was the sign? What was the sign that they needed? Well, on top of all the miracles and the healings, simply, Jesus is the sign. He is the sign from heaven. Those that saw it couldn't deny it, and everything Jesus did confirmed it, but those who couldn't see it couldn't be convinced. In 1994, a man wrote into a newspaper about a German terrorist group that he'd read about called Bader Meinhof. Now, this is a 1970s terrorist group, and this is like 25 years later after they had been established. He'd heard about them, and he wrote into this paper saying, "I heard about this terrorist group, and now I see them everywhere. I can't stop seeing them. I hear about them. I read about them. They pop up everywhere." And when he sent this into this paper published this article, and they noted other people were having the same effect. Now that we've run this article and run this idea of this Bader Meinhof, this terrorist group, people are seeing it everywhere. It became known as the Bader Meinhof phenomenon, that when you get introduced to something, you will now see that thing everywhere. When you buy those pair of shoes that no one else has, you go out, guess what? Everybody has those shoes now. When you get that car in that color that you thought was so unique, guess what? Everyone has that car in that color. When you get that phone, or you think you go to that place, or you found that hidden thing, suddenly you see and hear that thing everywhere. We have this sort of confirmation bias that we see something and then we see it over and over again, continuing to confirm the idea we already have in our mind. It's called the Bader Meinhof phenomenon. Those things didn't suddenly just appear out of nowhere. Those things weren't like they didn't happen before and now they happen now. We are now seeing those things, and we're seeing them over and over and over again. Eugene Peterson once wrote, "When we submit our lives to what we read in Scripture, we find that we are not being led to see God in our stories, but our stories in God's." God is the larger context and plot in which our stories find themselves. See, when we have our eyes open to see and our ears open to hear, we will see and hear God everywhere, and we will recognize we are part of God's great narrative, God's epic story, and we are invited to participate in it, to partner with God. But when we choose to ignore, when we choose to not see God or the movement of God, or we haven't woken up to what God is up to, we likely won't notice it. The love of God the Father, the way of Jesus, and the movement of the Spirit will fall on deaf ears and closed eyes. See, Jesus has been displaying his miraculous powers. But instead of seeing that as a sign, the religious elites dismiss them and can't see them at all. So Jesus says, essentially, the sign that you're looking for isn't coming. This is it. This is as good as it gets. He then leaves, gets in the boat, and crosses to the other side. Jesus was on the western side of the lake, and now they, Jesus and the disciples, are crossing up to the northeastern side. We'll continue on. Verse 14. "Now, they had forgotten to bring bread, and they had only one loaf with them in the boat. And he cautioned them, saying, 'Watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod.' And they began discussing with one another the fact that they had no bread." Okay, pause right there. This is like such a great moment. The disciples get into the boat with Jesus, 12 guys and Jesus, and only one guy seems to remember bread, and he only brings one loaf. Okay, I'm not saying that these guys are like, you know, super organized, like Excel spreadsheet kind of guys, but you would think somebody would have had the responsibility to bring food on the boat. But they didn't, and they get into this boat, and they do not seem to have more than just the one loaf of bread, and they are stressing about this, because what in the world are they going to eat? You get the humor in this situation, right? You see this, don't you? They're worried about bread, and the bread of life is literally with them. Jesus has just fed a total of 9,000 people on about 12 loaves of bread. And here, there's 13 of them, and they have one loaf. I think they're going to be okay. But they don't see that. So Jesus' response to them in the midst of this is, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Herod. So why does Jesus say that? The Pharisees are the Hebrew biblical literalists. They are the devout, close-minded, rule-following Israelites. And Herod is the king of Israel. He is the puppet king that is put in place by Rome, but he is by no means a practicing, faithful Hebrew king. His family was Jewish, but he was not faithful. And he did not have the knowledge or the commitments to the faith or to the law. Herod and his followers were thirsty for power as they were in this position. So Jesus says, you need to beware of the leaven of these two people. Why? Why the Pharisees and why Herod? Why is that a concern? Why is that something we need to be on the lookout? Like, is he going to get bread and bread us to death? Like, what is going on? Why do we need to be weary of this? See, when we make bread nowadays, we go to the grocery store and we buy frozen bread and heat it up in the oven, and that's how we make bread. But if you are going to make it a little bit more than scratch, then what you do is you go to the grocery store and you buy little packets of yeast or glass jars of yeast. And inside that, you open that up and there are these little microorganisms, these microscopic little granules that are yeast. And you activate those yeasts with warm water and sugar. And as that starts to activate, it grows and it spreads. But in ancient times, the way they made their bread and they used yeast and leaven wasn't going to the grocery store and buying those little things and dumping it in there. What they would do is they would take dough that had already been leavened and they would put it in the new dough. It's kind of like a friendship bread or sourdough, where you would take a starter of something else and put it in this new bread that you were rising. See, it wasn't something small or secret or hidden. It was something obvious that you would take out and you would put into it. Something that would get passed down from person to person, from generation to generation, something that would get handed down. And as you would pass down, it would be impacted by its leavening abilities to grow that next thing of bread. So this isn't something small or secret. It is something seen. It is something consumed. It is something that is passed down to others. And Jesus is saying, those that are strict, rule-following, biblical literalists that are passing something down to you, and those political, pseudo-religious leaders that are hungry for power are passing something down to you. And if you aren't careful, you will take what they are feeding you, it'll change you, and guess what? You will pass it down to someone else. You become what you give your time and attention to. You become what you consume. When we stay on a steady diet of destructive ways around us, we will become those things. It's like the movie Gremlins. We are all Mogwai, and if we get the wrong thing after midnight, it goes real bad, and it will fundamentally change us and lead us towards destruction. And the danger is, it doesn't just shape or change us or deform us, but it also deforms our view or our understanding of God. As John Mark Comer says, often what we believe about God says more about us than it does about God. Our theology is like a mirror to the soul. It shows us what is hidden deep inside. What voices are you letting speak to you? What voices are you letting shape your soul? What leavening agents are you letting into your life and passing on to other people. We continue, verse 17. And Jesus, aware of this, said to them, "Why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember? When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up?" Well, they said to him, 12. "And the 7 for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up?" And they said to him, 7. And he said to them, "Do you not yet understand?" Jesus has this come to Jesus moment, or he has this come to me moment where he says to them, "Why are you worried about bread? Do you not remember all that I've done? I've provided for thousands upon thousands upon thousands, and you are the ones I called to follow after me, to help lead this movement. Why would I not provide for you?" Then I love that Jesus breaks it down into math, and he says, let's just talk through the numbers here. In one hand, it feels like Jesus is being slightly pejorative to these people he's called and these disciples who gave up literally everything to follow him. And at the same time, it feels like they actually don't get it. He needs to literally walk it through again for them. The other day, we were all getting ready for bed, and Sarah says to the boys, she says, "Hey, brush your teeth like you have never brushed them before." In which I knew how they would hear that is, "Brush your teeth like I have no idea. I've never done this before. So let me put too much toothpaste on it, just waste half the thing, run it underwater, wash most, if not all of it off, gently run it by the front teeth, spit out what remaining toothpaste I had put on there, and walk out and say, 'I guess that's how you brush your teeth. Good night.'" Okay. So I interjected and I said, "Hold up, guys, real quick. I know you know how to brush your teeth. So don't brush them like you've never brushed them before, but like you haven't brushed them in a long time and they need a good cleaning." I'm pretty sure they still did the same thing, but regardless, I felt better about myself. I had to explain to my 10 and 11-year-old how to brush their teeth. They know how to do this. This feels pejorative and insulting to them, but I need to make sure they've got it. Jesus is doing the same thing with the disciples here. He needs to make sure they get it because so much is riding on this. But there's something else that's happening here that's so lovely. When Jesus feeds that first group, it's Hebrew people, and they have just 5 loaves of bread for 5,000 people, and they feed them from that. And how many baskets are left over? 12 baskets. 12. 12 is one of the perfect numbers in the Hebrew culture. 12 is how many children of Abraham, how many tribes of Israel. It is the number of tribes that the Israelites have. So it had 5, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, the Torah, the Pentateuch. 5 fed them. And then they had 12 left over that signified they had enough. Not long after that, when they have the second group, the Gentile group that they needed to feed them, they have just 7 loaves to feed 4,000 people. The other perfect number besides 12 is 7. 7 means that in Hebrew, it means complete, it means whole, it means holiness. And they had 7 loaves, and then they ended up with 7 baskets. Those that were brought in, those that were welcomed in, they were invited to be a part of this family. See, Jesus feeding welcomed in the chosen, the family of Abraham, the 12 tribes of Israel, and the outsiders, the Gentiles, those who weren't even looking for a sign. Jesus was bringing them into the fold and into the family. And of course, Jesus can feed the 13 of them with just 1 loaf of bread. He's Jesus, and yet they seem to be forgetting that. But also, he's making a massive theological statement. Everyone is invited to the table. Everyone is invited to experience the heavenly banquet. Jesus is taking their moment of forgetfulness or worry or stress or fear or scarcity mindset and is both reassuring them that there is enough for everyone and there is enough for you and for me. Don't let the closed-mindedness of the Pharisees infiltrate your perspective. Don't miss who I am because they have been rattling off some rhetoric that tries to discredit me. Don't let the manipulative people of power like Herod and his followers infiltrate your perspective. Don't miss who I am because I'm caring for outsiders, welcoming in the forgotten, blessing all people so that they can know and trust me. Don't let your hearts be hardened, your ears to be closed, or your eyes to be blinded. See, I am the sign of the times. I am the bread of life. I am the one who has more than enough for everyone, including you. But I don't think they get it. So what does this mean for us? What is this saying for us today? Almost a decade ago, Sarah and I stepped into working with college-age people. We had stepped into a ministry with very few students, very few resources, and a rundown building. Over the next 7-8 years, we were able to see incredible ministry happen, hundreds and hundreds of students to follow after Jesus, and we had the opportunity to renovate a facility and do some just awesome stuff. In 2020, when the world was on pause, we got contacted about coming here. And when Sarah and I were on a walk one time reflecting, do we walk away from everything we've done here in Dallas, or do we stay, or do we go? What do we do here? And she said, I wish there was like a big billboard that told us what to do. I wish there was a sign, right? And then we started to talk and pray and reflect through it, and every single thing that was keeping us there, slowly God was just closing the door on. Every single thing that we thought was the priority for us to stay was closing the door. And as we talked through that and reflected upon that, I said, Sarah, I think he has shown us a sign. He's closed everything here. That is when we made the decision that we were called to be here, to minister here, to lead, to love, to be a part of this place. See, I don't know what you're going through. I don't know what experiences and questions you have, but you probably have things that maybe you feel like God is leading you in a certain direction, but you just want a sign to know if it's true or if you're supposed to follow after that. Well, speak those out. Talk those things out with those that you love, those who know you, those who are faithful, those who are devout and following after Jesus, and you will see, I believe, what the signs are pointing towards. And you will have confidence and an ability to step in as you start to follow after those signs. See, sometimes the signs we are looking for are right in front of us. We just miss them because we are looking at other things or we're not paying attention. Sometimes we miss these things that God has for us because we are looking at other things. I don't know what you're wrestling through right now, but I'm guessing you have something you are trying to figure out. Next steps in life or faith, decisions or relationship or a job, how to handle a situation or what to do or what to say. And many of us are not looking for Jesus to guide us in this. We've actually closed the door and not invited him into that conversation because we think he doesn't care or he's not involved. But he does, and he is. He wants the best for you. He wants a rich and abundant and meaningful, fulfilling life. And I don't mean financially rich or great vacations, a life that is rich with the blessings of God. The original call of Abraham was blessed to be a blessing, and we are called to continue that as well. He has an abundant life for you. He calls you to follow after him and experience life in him and through him. And when we look for him, we will experience the life he has for us. You want a sign? Jesus is the sign you are looking for. St. Augustine of Hippo said, "Late have I loved you, beauty so old and so new. Late have I loved you, and see, you were within, and I was in the external world and sought you there. And in my unlovely state, I plunged into those lovely created things which you made. You were with me, and I was not with you." Augustine is saying, I did not recognize you were with me. And I threw myself headlong into all the things of this world instead of you. And I missed where you were leading me. But you were with me the whole time. How can we recognize that the sign is with us, that Jesus is journeying with us, that the Spirit guides us? See, he is what we are looking for. He can guide our decisions. He can guide our actions. Let us lift those up to him. They will be the sign of confirmation. Doesn't mean you'll get the answer today. Doesn't mean you'll get the answer soon. But when you lean upon him, I believe it will constantly redirect you, re-guide you, and put you in a trajectory that impacts the world and eternity. Let us trust in him as the sign who leads to life and life everlasting here and now. Let us pray. Gracious and loving God, help us to recognize that you are the sign that brings life and life abundant. Help us to recognize you are the one who welcomes us in and welcomes others in. You are the one who swings open the doors for Jews and Gentiles. You are the one who gives us life and life abundant. Help us to recognize you are the sign. Help us to trust in you. Help us to follow after you. Help us to know that you love us. We love you, Jesus. We pray these things in your holy and precious name. Amen. We like to carve out a few moments at the end of